You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Last week, the Tokyo Olympics concluded after being delayed by a year due to the COVID-19 pandemic. However, the Games were forced behind closed doors as Japan experienced its highest spike of infections. On the Olympics opening day, Japan recorded over 4,000 new cases, with the majority in Tokyo. Recently, other major international events have also returned, with many letting fans in, such as the European Football Championships, which allowed almost 60,000 spectators at the final in London. But while these events are often heralded as a spectacle, they also come with considerable economic, health, and social criticisms. In Tokyo, these criticisms resulted in polls which claimed over 80% of Japan opposed the Games, alongside protesters outside the Olympic Stadium. So, to get an understanding of this opposition and the impact the Games have had in Japan, I spoke to Satoko Itani. Itani is an associate professor in sports, gender, and sexuality at Kansai University in Tokyo, and was heavily involved in the organization of the protests. To start, I asked them to explain what their demands had been, and how they have changed since the Games.
Before the opening ceremony, definitely the first thing that people were asking was to cancel the Olympics and right to put, and then protect lives. Really, this Olympic really strengthened my belief that the Olympic is a really a big issue, and in order to change this problem, in order to really the IOC has to be abolished once, because it's such a corrupt and an abusive organization. And as you can see now, Japan is experiencing the worst surge of the infection of the COVID-19 right now. Like, the number started to go up right during the Olympic, and then the hospitals are completely overwhelmed. And this is not some, this wasn't a surprise. Doctors have warned that this was going to happen before the Olympic during the global pandemic, so we should cancel it. And there were overwhelming voices. And yet, IOC, and they have zero interest of taking any responsibility of what is going on. I mean, they can't, because, the IOC is the institution that doesn't allow the cancellation, even in this condition, and not taking responsibility, not even apologizing or acknowledging the horrible situation that the people in Japan have to live.
Were these protests primarily about the associated health risks with the Games, or was it also to do with the huge economic cost and the political issues as well?
There were a lot of people, so each weekend, and so different people protested. But yes, the economical damage to the country was one of them, because it's now become the pattern. The organizing committee usually spend like way more amount of money than they originally promised. And it turned out most expensive Summer Olympic ever. And also the displacement of the poor community, you know, our house people, that's also a big concern time. And also the militarization of the community, and also increasing the police power or the presence of the police. And these are the things that people are really concerned.
Yeah, because on that, just from our perspective in New Zealand, the Games have been kind of portrayed as a huge success with a lot of focus on the athletes and their achievements. But given there's been such concern around the Games in Japan and in Tokyo, do you think that it was a tale of two sides, that there was a bit of ignorance towards what's been happening in Tokyo?
Right. I mean, yeah, there was almost a surreal experience for me, or the surge of the COVID-19 in Japan. Is people say it's like having a disaster. And yet, if you turn on the TV, for 15 minutes, they do the news and touch upon some seriousness of the situation, but then they quickly switch to the Olympics. And they don't mention anything about their current coronavirus situation. Wherever you watch, whichever channel of the TV you watch, it's always the Olympics. So it was really hard to have a sense of urgency or the sense of the crisis that we were in. So I think that really, like, again, contributed to people not taking enough precautions.
Yeah, on that, do you think that the extreme precautions, because obviously there are a lot, there was the bubble and there were athletes having to leave immediately after events, do you think that these precautions were enough?
They say bubble and safe and secure, but as of yesterday, as far as I know, over 500 cases, right, were found within the bubble. And then outside the bubble, there were, like, right now just keep surging. And so I don't think that the athletes are kept safe, and I don't think the public are kept safe because they gathered, right? It spread because the Olympics came, and then people's behavior changed. And also the news media is reporting that the very first case of Lambda variant brought in Japan before the Olympics started, a few days before the Olympics, but they kept the information from the public until the Olympic ended. People were very angry about that, and it turned out that the very first case happened with the Olympic visitor. So there's a lot of hiding of the information, and people don't trust the government anymore. And when people don't trust government, it's really difficult to control.
So yeah, mentioning the health risks, since the games began, Japan's daily COVID cases have only increased. Yesterday, I believe there were almost 20,000 new cases, with most of those in Tokyo. Given there's been such a spike, do you think the Olympics and the 500 cases that have been recorded have played a role in this?
The main concern, and I have been saying this too, is like, even if the bubble stood, even if the Olympic bubble sealed it, all the infections, would they not be revealed? That was horrible too, because Africa got infected. But anyway, but people's behavior changes. Like, there are a lot of cases of police officers coming from different parts of Japan to provide a security in Tokyo. They are infected while they are in Tokyo, and they are bringing back to the home cities. But, you know, and that same thing, volunteers and other personnel.
Yeah, because that's something that I wanted to touch on, because you mentioned a lot around the officials being their behavior changing. But has there been a change in how ordinary people have interacted with precautions and isolation measures as the cases have risen during the Olympics?
There are thousands of people around the stadium gathering also, and then all the venues were visited by a lot of people. So that alone is concerning. But also, Tokyo was under the state of emergency. So that means that the restaurants or izakaya places couldn't provide, or the heritage closed the business at 8 p.m. and not serve any alcohol. But those businesses, many businesses can no longer afford to do that because the government is not providing enough support. So many restaurants, businesses remained open after 8 o'clock or kept providing the alcohol. But also there were a lot of cases where people gathered with friends and family and drink and watch the game who traveled around Japan. So yeah, the worst spike is around Tokyo, but the number is going up in major tourist destinations such as Okinawa or Osaka and Kyushu, right? So this is not just around Tokyo. This starts to happen everywhere, basically, because people moved around a lot.
What you're saying, I guess, is almost opposite to what the IOC have said at the closing of the games last Sunday. The head of the IOC that said that the competition was one of hope, solidarity, and peace. What do you have to say about that?
So what kind of hopes and solidarity that we have in Japan after months of having the Olympics? Like, there are tens of thousands of people struggling right now because they are infected but cannot even go to the hospital. And people are upset that the Olympics happened. And then some people are happy during the 2 weeks watching the games, but now realizing how serious the situation has become. So, you know, there are so many different ways to have a peace. There are group of people who are actually doing more solid direct action to bring peace to the world, not sports. The Olympics do not. There is no evidence of the Olympics bringing a peace to the world.
That was Satoko Itani, who is an associate professor in sports, gender, and sexuality at Kansai University in Tokyo, and was heavily involved in the organization of the protests. Next, I spoke to COVID-19 modeling expert and University of Auckland professor Sean Hendy about the risks posed by major events like the Olympics and what precautions are needed. I began by asking what his perspective was on the return of major international sporting events.
Yeah, look, it's a difficult decision for countries to make. Obviously, these are important events for people, and they do provide a lot of pleasure for fans and so forth. But you know, we have seen now, and you know, particularly from the European Championship, that there were kick-on cases that resulted from that championship games. It's not necessarily just that people go to the stadiums and pick up the virus, but actually people often will go to bars or other venues to watch the games, and in those kind of indoor environments you can get spread. So you know, the benefits of allowing these sorts of things to go ahead have to be weighed up against the downsides of promoting spread of the virus.
Yeah, because obviously there are major downsides. Just specifically, what are the risks of these events? How can transmission occur in them?
Yeah, so you know, the big risk is in indoor events. So, and this could be if you, you know, if you're in a bar or a restaurant watching the game, you might be indoors. That bar or restaurant might be poorly ventilated, and you could be in close contact with someone who's carrying the virus for, you know, for the duration of the game. And that increases the chances of you picking up the virus from that person. Going to a stadium or viewing a sporting event where the stadium is well ventilated is less of a risk. Although, of course, when you're entering and exiting a stadium, you can be in close contact with people. And mixing with those people, you know, it might be very hard to track those cases as well. So there are, you know, there are risks from being in close contact with people, and events like these do bring people into close contact.
Are there any precautions that event organisers and governments can put in place that can ensure that events run safely while still?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, trying to facilitate the jobs of contact tracers, you know, should an infected person be present at an event, making it easier for contact tracers to trace those that have come into contact with. So that includes making sure that people have assigned seating at a venue so that they can be traced should they have been exposed to someone at that venue. I think also controlling access to bars, restaurants where people might gather to watch the game, perhaps putting size limits on the number of people that can be in venues where the game might be broadcast. Those sorts of things can help mitigate the spread.
Yeah, the indirect impacts are something you've mentioned a little bit, but I spoke to Satoko Itani yesterday, who was involved in the protests against the Tokyo Olympics. They said that one of the biggest issues in Tokyo was behavioural change, with a lot of people watching the games together or police coming from other provinces during the games. Do you think that the indirect impacts of these events are potentially more damaging than direct impacts?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it depends on the event, but certainly that's probably the greatest risk is less from people being in the venues. And obviously, you can, as with the games, you know, many of the venues were closed, so they weren't open to the public. So it's these indirect effects. It's people gathering to watch games together that is the real problem. So if you can take steps to try and mitigate that, you know, mandating masks in restaurants, for example, you know, then that can help reduce those risks.
And just continuing on the theme of the Olympic Games for the meantime, there were around 500 cases which were recorded in the Olympic Village. Most of these were Japanese nationals. And this has been followed by high COVID spikes. Do you think that there may be a correlation between the high COVID cases in the Olympics?
Yeah, look, I think so. I mean, obviously, the Olympics were, you know, a big logistical event. They would have brought together lots of people in close contact, even absent spectators. So it's quite likely that there were secondary effects from the Olympics.
And because obviously there were people coming from around the world, there were journalists, there were athletes, does this not just pertain risks to the host nation, but also people around the world as well, other countries that were involved?
Yeah, certainly that's also a risk with people increasing travel coming from different parts of the world. I mean, obviously, countries have to put in forms of border control at the moment to try and manage risks from, you know, spread from other countries, and that includes New Zealand. But anything that brings large numbers of people together at the moment, particularly from different parts of the world, has the potential to spread the virus.
And does the Delta variant and other variants change how precautions at these events should be put in place?
Yeah, look, Delta is particularly challenging. It is roughly twice, maybe even more transmissible than the wild type variant that we were dealing with last year. So it means that some of the things we were doing last year, which proved effective, may be far less effective against Delta. So certainly, you know, we have to recalculate and rethink some of the things that we've allowed to take place last year or earlier this year in light of the Delta variant.
That was COVID-19 modelling expert and University of Auckland Professor Sean Hendy. Finally, I spoke to Mark Falkus, who's an associate professor in sport policy and sociology at the University of Otago. We spoke about the pressures that influenced the return of these events. To start, I asked him what the benefits of staging major sporting events were despite the ongoing pandemic.
The advocates of these events will normally point to economic regeneration, the idea of attracting inward investment to the places where they're held. So obviously there's competition, let's say in the Olympic Games, between cities to host. We'll talk about boosting tourism, effective ways to put, for a city to put itself on the map, creation of new facilities and sort of infrastructure, might be transport and sort of urban landscapes around venues and so on, and the chance to sort of represent their culture on a world stage. So these are all the sorts of reasons that the advocates of these kinds of events will use, if you like, to promote and legitimate the events. But there are all the public health issues associated with it. And there's a significant risk with hosting mega events anyway, financially and otherwise. But obviously with the COVID situation, yeah, as far as public health goes, probably one of the worst things you can do is host an event and draw in people. It's sort of the ideal super spreader event. But that seemed to be managed at the Olympic Games on this time around. So it is possible, but there's certainly risks, yeah.
Yeah, because the Olympics Games, obviously they banned fans, but it still cost the government an estimated $15 billion. With no tourism to support domestic economy and all of that, why would the Japanese invest so much into it? What's the domestic benefit?
Well, there's very little, actually, in the context of a pandemic. So the way the rights work for the Olympic Games is that the IOC takes the broadcast rights and all the sponsorship revenue. And the only way for a host city to recoup the money is really in ticket sales. And obviously in this case, that was not going to recoup any money for Tokyo. So it was a particularly bad deal financially for Tokyo. And then, of course, they had to the added expenditure of all the special measures they needed to put in place around the pandemic. So it was a lose-lose situation for Tokyo in that regard.
So where then has the pressure come for them to host the event?
Well, obviously, it was awarded pre-pandemic. And then in terms of pressure, obviously, there's a set of economic pressures and forces, if you like. The IOC, obviously, are going to stand to benefit from the hosting of the Games. The major sponsors are going to benefit. The major broadcasters are going to benefit. Typically, the host city would benefit in some ways, although that's quite contested if you look at all the research in this area, because it's quite a complicated equation of the way in which it does impact cities. But the pressure's really coming through, obviously, the IOC, vested economic interests, broadcasters and sponsors. That's who is advocating hosting the event. The Tokyo taxpayer is fundamentally the one that's paying for the party.
Yeah, because many of the Japanese population came strongly out against the events, with some polls recording an over 80% disapproval. I've seen many people say that sporting events should be apolitical and separated from politics of the pandemic. But given such large costs, how political are these events?
They're always political. So the idea that they shouldn't be political is just a myth. And they're always political. Political in the sense that they always serve vested interests. They always serve particular interest groups over others. Even in their normal everyday runnings, when we don't, what you might call, overtly politicise them, there are certain groups who are winning, certain groups who are losing. So you simply can't make the case that they're ever apolitical. And that's simply a myth. Sport does not operate in that way. It's always involved in political context, political cultural context. So that's sort of an argument that I wouldn't really buy into.
Yeah, just specifically, you mentioned there's going to be groups who are winning and losing. Who are these groups?
Oh, the interest groups around, let's say, a mega event like the Olympic Games, as I've said, is the IOC, the sponsors and broadcasters. And it's interesting, when we look at sort of commercial returns around the Olympic movement, a lot of rhetoric is sort of offered around the gains and benefits, let's say, to local economies. But even when we look at the research around that, it tends to be heavily concentrated, for example, in the service sector. It tends to be focused on the big corporations that benefit in CBDs of cities and so on, rather than more broadly dispersed across local economies. So there's even a concentration when you think about drilling down into the debate around the sort of economic inputs that an event can bring. So we need quite detailed analyses to sort of make sense of who is winning and who's losing, because it's not so simple as just to say there's an economic benefit that, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats. It actually tends to be a little bit more sector specific and a little bit more concentrated than it does sort of.
Yes, you touch on the sector specific and that there are differences between groups. Do you think that it's a story of two sides almost for the companies and the governments who benefit financially and politically, and those individuals who bear the huge costs and pandemic-related risks?
Yeah, absolutely. So taxpayers are basically footing the bill for the party, overwhelmingly. Not solely, but overwhelmingly. If you look at, I mean, even the bidding processes around things like the Olympic Games, I mean, Chicago had a failed bid for the Olympic Games in 2016, and it reportedly cost about $100 million, you know, for a failed bid. So that's an awful lot of money invested in something that didn't come off. So when we think about, let's say, the Olympic Games as a mega event, we also have to remember all the expenditure into those failed bids as well.
Just moving on slightly, globally, governments have tended to show greater willingness to host and allow fans in sporting events recently, despite COVID cases remaining high. Do you think that this represents a change of policymakers and people's mindsets?
Not really, no. I don't think necessarily. I think it's propelled by the idea of economic interests, fundamentally. It's interesting, when we take a longer-term perspective, you know, way pre-pandemic, there was a rise in the way in which cities would bid, in particular, let's say, for the Olympic Games, but that actually tailed off quite significantly, and there's been very much far fewer bidders for Olympic Games in recent Olympiads, because it's become more and more apparent that actually economic benefits, gains, etc., aren't really borne out, and there's often huge overruns in expenditure. The classic one was Montreal in 1976 in terms of overruns, and it took a quarter of a century for the Canadians to pay that off, or Montrealers to pay that off. So, you know, the more recent sort of impetus to host like the European Football Championships and the Olympic Games and so on, I think is propelled by more immediate economic interests. But the appeal of these events has definitely waned in more recent years because the economics of them don't tend to stack up as well as some of the sort of ambitious rhetoric has suggested.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.